So what is it? See? It's not like Glee or something, is it? Calf, what is this? Let's have a look, come on. Let's see. Ah.
What's that?
15, that's okay. Ooh. Facing a choice of mine. What? Ooh. Well, at least he could die. Oh, is that the baby? Oh, yeah, that'd be scary. That is a baby.
Oh,
yeah, it is. It is a baby. Something's not dead.
Was it Kate?
Hang out, drink, send texts, and watch the story unfold. Isn't that what you do already in real life? Like, hang out, drink, and send texts? Nah, it looks interesting. So don't mess with Catherine, eh? Is that good? Oh, there's no game in there. It's new. Oh, that's your weekend taken care of then. Oh my God. No, you can't. Well, you can write about the games we've looked at, but not any game. Not about Catherine, obviously. Yeah?
I'm power checking Simon.
Yeah?
What should I compare? Because I have some random number, like for example, 37 nodes.
Right, but you see,
right or not.
Does it seem reasonable? Is it less? That's the thing, right? There's no absolute that can give you like the perfect idea of what. But how about against whatever you? Yeah, that's the idea of comparing, right? Does it get better? That's it. It's all relative. Because if I tell you it's 40 nodes, I don't want you to spend hours and hours trying to get it to. Or I tell you, you can do it in 30 nodes with 30 nodes. It's not worth it spending hours trying to get it to 30. No longer than 5 minutes.
For each program or for all the problems?
Oh, for any of the problems, basically.
Yeah, no, so far it's okay. It's also not power checking, so it's okay.
How long? That's not too bad. You are trying Sudoku.
The guy said, well, it can take even an hour.
Yeah.
It's less than a minute, but probably it's my super duper cool computer.
Oh, it must be. Well, you got like a super computer at home. How are you doing? Good. Is that your super duper computer, eh? Yeah, it looks big enough. What's it got? Is that an i7 in there? Is the processor i7, i5? Alright, Petro's got an i5 as well, so. Of course, so you see, this is an i7. There you go. It's an i7. Higher. Oh, it's just in terms of the speed, right? It's just Intel making more money out of people. Most people are happy, an i5 is more than enough. Because what they're doing now, they're not trying to gain a lot of in terms of speed, right? It's about the number of, it's the pipelines and all this, right? If anything, the clock speed has decreased. Exactly, but a lot of programs are not even taking advantage of this yet, right? Because now we're talking about parallel programming, multi-core programming. Oh, yeah. That's, yeah. It's basically the graphics people, absolutely. It's quite funny, like in 10, 15 years time, 20 years, we'll be laughing when we hear like four cores, because computers are going to have like hundreds of cores, eventually. It'll be funny. All right, guys, ready?
Are we ready?
We are. This one's so much better. Oh. Okay. Let's start. So hopefully you guys are making some progress. So how was the Haskell lecture yesterday? Was it good? No, was it helpful? It's difficult to do these kind of lectures which are a bit more kind of applied and looking at things, and you know, because sometimes we're wondering whether we do it in the lab or not. Okay, so if it was helpful, that's good. Okay. So, oh, then remember, right, so you should go, if you, you know, you should make use of Petros and go to the lab if you can, if you have any questions on Wednesdays, right, between 4 and 6. Okay, so we're going to carry on. What we're going to look at is unification and this general kind of general version of modus ponens, which is a it's an inference rule. Right, that enables us basically. So today we're not going to look at using generalized mode. We're not going to look at how it can be used to actually find proofs. We're just going to introduce the notion of generalized modus ponens. And this is from Russell and Norvig, 9.1 to 9.2. Right, and unification is just the idea that we want to find substitutions for variables. We'll see that in a bit. So what's the outline of this course? So we're going to see how, in some situations, it is possible to reduce first-order inference to proportional inference. And this is good because...
proposition is more powerful.
What does that mean? More powerful? What is more powerful?
It's greater functionality.
No? It's decidable. That's what you want. It's not got more. It's not more powerful in representation-wise. Proportional is less powerful than first-order logic, right? But at least you can have a decision. You can have decision procedures for proportional logic, which is not the case for first-order. We'll see this. So there, in some situations, it's quite nice to be able to reduce a first-order problem to a proportional problem. And if not, in general, when we can't do this, we need this idea of unification. And we're going to see how then we can use this to have just a general version of, you know about modus ponens, I'm guessing, right? What is modus ponens?
It's like when we have an implication.
Yep, it is when we have an implication.
And we have the first side of the implication, which is given, so we can use the second side.
Yeah, well, roughly. Yeah, so this is the modus ponens rule, right? If I have A, then I have A implies B, then I can deduce B. All right, so that's what I mean by modus ponens. We're going to look at a generalized version of this. Well, A here has to match the assumption of the implication, right? Yeah. Yeah, that's what you meant?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I knew that's what you meant. Good. So, okay. And to start with, what we're going to do is to look at this idea of reducing first order problem to a proportional problem. But to be able to do this, we need to introduce two other inference rules. So one is known as universal instantiation, or UI, right? What does this say? It says that every instantiation of a universally quantified formula alpha is entailed by it, right? This is saying if we have a formula of the kind for all v alpha, right, then we can replace all occurrences of v in alpha by some other term, right? For instance, it could be a constant, right? And this is going to entail this. So we're saying, you know, we're writing it like this, saying from this follows, right? Of course, the other way we could have written this. Oh my God, how am I going to do this? Ah, I've got a terrible pain. I'm telling this to everybody. So the other way we've seen this, if we're writing it like that, is this notion of entailment, right? So alpha v. Yeah, so remember we saw this, right? The single turnstile. So that's an inference rule. So for any variable v, any ground term, so we could say that, yeah, so one way of looking at it which makes it even more specific is that for any variable v, any ground term g, any ground term means it contains no variable, right? So for instance, the constant, or it's a function symbol applied to a constant, or it's a function symbol to apply to another function symbol, apply to another function symbol, apply to a constant, right? There are no variables in the term, right? So this is saying if this is true, then this is true, right? So here's an example. If I have for all x, king x and greedy x implies that x is evil, right? Then by this rule, these all follow from this, right? These are all entailed by this. So king, if I replace x by John, king John, greedy John implies evil John, Richard, etc., etc. But it could also be king father of John, and greedy father of John implies evil father of John. So it's a function symbol applied to a constant. All happy with this? So these are all the possibilities. So if you remember last time we said, right, so one way you do this is that you just enumerate all, you know, with all the constants in your domain. But things get more complicated once you start having function symbol, because I could come up with another one, which is king, father, father of John, right, like the grandfather of John. Greedy, father, father of John implies evil, father, father of John. So once we have function symbol, things get, effectively, you end up with an infinite number of possible instantiations, right? So that's one rule. And the other one is the existential instantiation one, which is maybe a bit more, well, which shouldn't be too difficult. For any formula alpha, variable v, and some constant symbol k that does not, that's the important bit, right, appear elsewhere in the knowledge base, right, we are able to say there exists a v alpha entails that alpha with v replaced by this fresh k, this new k, right? It's like saying, you know, I'm saying there exists something, but I don't know what it is. So I'm, but basically, I want to say there exists an intelligent student, right? Or there exists an intelligent lecturer. It doesn't necessarily mean it's me, and you know it's not me, right? So, but this means, you know, I should be able to reason with this and just pick some arbitrary lecturer. So what you would do, say, if I said exists an intelligent lecturer, without knowing who it is, you would pick an arbitrary constant and put it in there, right? So just to give you an example, it says there exists a crown X, and X is on the head of John, right? What I would do this to instantiate this, I would say, well, let me pick some C1, right, which is a new constant that doesn't occur already, right? And call this, it's known as a column constant. And I can say this, crown C1, on head C1, John. So when you have this existential, you need to pick a fresh constant, something that hasn't occurred anywhere. And then hopefully you're going to try and do a deduction with this. Because if you look at the sentence, it's not telling you what crown, right? It's not telling you about a particular crown. It just tells you there exists a crown, right? And if you want to reason about it, you're going to say, okay, let's just assume it's something, some crown C1. I'm going to use this in my reasoning. If I can make the reasoning and I can deduce something or I can prove something based on this arbitrary C1, then it's the same as saying that I deduce something based on the fact that, you know, I just assume there exists an X, which I didn't know what it was, right? So it has to be fresh. Are you happy with this? So if you're asked to give the existential instantiation rule, right, you're supposed to give this bit, but you also have to say this bit, right? So that's actually important. That proviso there is also part of the rule. So for any formula, so basically you write this, but then you have to say K is fresh, or K has not been seen before. So that's part of the rule as well. It has to be stated. Because otherwise, if you replace it by some constant that you've already seen, it's actually possible to have an unsound reasoning. The reasoning is not sound anymore. It's not necessarily sound anymore, right? Okay. So two rules. With these two rules, basically enables us, you know, to reduce problems that are in first order logic, or without, especially those without function symbols, because that's the problem, basically to a proportional problem. So let's assume we have this right now. We have the KB as before. Remember, we saw this for all X, king X, greedy X implies evil X. And we also have like king John and greedy John and brother Richard John, right? So what we can do is to instantiate the universal variable in all possible ways, right? So for instance, we can have this where we make X John, another one where we make X Richard, and we already have this and this and this. So these are all the possible ways, right? Are they? Yeah, they are, right? So we can only have, we only have two constants in this case and no function symbol, so we've found all the ways of instantiating this X there, right? So this is our new propositionalized KB, right? So the new KB is propositionalized, right? And these are the proportion symbols now. You have like this already, King John, which was given to you already was there, Greedy John, and you also have Evil John and King Richard, right? So, et cetera, et cetera,
Right, so these are the proportion symbols. So you have no variables anymore. And once you have no variables anymore, really, this is just a proportional letter, right? So I could have said this is going to be called KJ, for instance, right? I don't have to worry about what it is, as long as it means just one thing. It's going to be just true or false, right? So, but note that we also have this one, for instance, right? So we're talking about all the proportional symbols that occur in these, right? So King John, Greedy John, Evil John, Evil Richard, and King Richard, right? So, but King Richard, if you look at this, we're saying, you know, it's a proportional symbol that occurs in there, right? But it wasn't originally in the knowledge base, right? It's something that we have now because we've done an instantiation. Are you with me?
Yeah.
Right? Okay. So it's not in the KB as a fact. So what we're trying to say is that every fold, right, every first order logic knowledge base can be turned into one where you have propositions or propositionalize so as to preserve entailment. I have a problem with this every year. I don't know why. So to preserve entailment, so, right? So this means you don't lose anything. What does it mean to say it preserves entailment? That's exactly it, right? If it was entailed before, it's still entailed, right? That's all that matters. So basically, you're not. If it was possible to prove it before to show that it followed from this, you're not going to lose anything, right? So basically, what is it going to preserve? What else does it preserve then, if it's like that? Hopefully, correctness is too general, but you're right. But it's more than that. What the particular type of correctness, if you want to look at it like this, it's going to preserve completeness. Right? Hopefully. If it was complete, if you had an algorithm before that was complete, things will still remain. You're not going to lose anything that you could derive before. Right? So a ground sentence then is entailed by the new KB if it is entailed by the original KB, which you just read there, obviously. See, that's the problem. I ask this thing, really, this shouldn't be there. Whenever I ask these very deep questions and have the answer next to it. But it's okay, at least you're reading the slide, which is always good. And so the idea is that once you have your KB with proportion letters, with just proportions, right, then you can query it and just apply something like DPLL, right? So Davis-Putnam method, right? Or some other complete proportional method and return the result. So if you've been able to convert your first order logic KB into a proportional logic one, right, and, you know, in a nice way, you know, entailment is preserved, then, you know, you don't have to worry. You can just use whatever you know about proportional logic decision procedures, such as DPLL or another one, which is not complete. We looked at this briefly. With randomness.
Something SAT.
WalkSAT, exactly. Something SAT, yes. So WalkSAT, right, which has a bit, an element of randomness in there, which tries to balance, you know, between being greedy and not. So, yeah, something SAT. We'll see in the exam whether you write something SAT. Yeah, something sad. Well, at least you know there's something sad. Yeah, so WalkSat, for instance, right? But of course, you know, WalkSat is not complete. Here we would like something which is complete, right? And return the result. But of course, like I was saying, right, the problem is when you have function symbols, this doesn't work very well. Because now you have infinitely many ground terms, right? So once you have function symbols, this doesn't work very well. Because I could have father, et cetera, et cetera. And each one of these now corresponds to one proportional letter, right? And it's infinitely many of these now. So that's going to be problematic. So is there a way of dealing with that? Well, yes, there is a way of dealing with that, at least to some extent. But of course, you know, the trick is, the problem is that it says to infinity, right? So there's a theorem from Herbrand from 1930, which is a very well-known theorem in logic, right? If a sentence alpha is entailed by first order logic KB, it is going to be entailed by a finite subset of the propositionalized KB. So what it's saying is that if it is entailed by the original KB, by substituting, going deeper and putting deeper and deeper terms and substituting, eventually I should be able to get a KB, which is just with propositions, that will entail it, right? So it is possible to preserve it. Except the problem is a finite subset, it doesn't tell you how finite that subset is, right? So here's the idea there. The idea is that one way I could try to do this is say for n from 0 to whatever, infinity, go on forever, create a proportional KB by instantiating with depth n terms. So initially I would instantiate with what? What's a depth 0 term? No, terms, if we're talking about terms.
John.
Yeah, which is known, which is also known as a? Exactly. So if depth zero terms, so basically what this is saying is that initially let's instantiate with all the constants, like John, Richard, whatever is there, right? So that would be depth zero, right? And then at depth one, it says, okay, let's do something depth one. So let's assume my function symbol that I have lying around is father, right? So what would be depth one? Father of, well, father of John and father of Richard, right? And then you keep going like this. So what would be depth two? Et cetera, et cetera. Of course, remember, you could have another one, mother, right, as well. So then you would have also. And then what would happen here? You would also have father of mother of John, right, et cetera. So you can see it's blowing up, right? So you'd have father, father, you'd have mother, mother, father, mother, mother, father. Almost swearing. So it's all of these kind of things there. So but you gets deeper and deeper, and then you reach level three, and you keep going and keep going. So what it's saying is that eventually at some depth n, right, which is a finite depth, you will be able to prove that alpha follows. Except the n could be arbitrarily deep. Right? So it gets harder and harder as your number of propositional constants, or your number of propositions in your KB increases, gets harder and harder, obviously. Right? So, you know, you could reach a point where you have 1,000 of these, because each one of these corresponds to a propositional letter, right? So effectively, this is like saying this is P, this is Q, et cetera, because they're all ground, right? So it gets harder and harder. So what we have here is a theoretical result, which is very nice, right? But in practice, is that things don't work that well, right? So also the other thing is this, right? If alpha is entailed, it loops forever. It works if alpha is entailed. But if alpha is not entailed, what would happen? You would keep going forever because you're trying to prove that it's that it follows, right? From the propositional database that you have, you're being bigger, bigger, but you'll never be able to prove this, so you never stop. It keeps going. I mean, saying that it loops is a bit of a weird. It just keeps, you know, it just keeps going. It gets bigger and bigger. You do more and deeper n there, but you're never going to be able to prove it. Which is good, which is to be expected, because it's linked to another very, very important result from the 30s, right? Turing and Church, which says that entailment for first order logic is semi-decidable, right? This means that algorithms are going to exist that say yes to every entailed sentence. So if something is entailed, you have an algorithm that will say yes eventually, right? Even for first order logic. And this is what they're saying. But you don't have any algorithms that exist that also say no to every non-entailed sentence. If you did, you would have what's known as a? Yeah, you would have a decision procedure. So what this is saying, you don't have any decision procedure. Because a decision procedure will tell you either yes or no, right? But this is saying, if it is entailed, fine. You will be able to show that it is. But if it's not, and you don't know whether it's entailed or not, you could keep going forever. But the fact that you haven't found a solution, you haven't been able to show that it's not entailed, doesn't mean that it's not entailed. Right? It could be that it's entailed at an like this is showing us is that it's arbitrarily deep. You may need to go to be able to show that something is entailed or not. Happy? Yeah. Sure? Any questions? Okay. So it's quite funny, right? So what we've covered in this on this slide are two very deep results from mathematical logic, actually. You're expected to go in Russell and Novick and figure out the proofs for this, and it's examinable, obviously. So that was a whole thesis for this, so a PhD. So, yes. But they're very important results because they tell us what sort of things that we can do when we're actually trying to do some kind of automated reasoning or theorem proving. We're trying to do things automatically. So, you know, our expectation shouldn't be very high in a way. Well, that's putting it a bit harshly, but if you're working first with the logic, you know, you can't expect that you're going to have an algorithm that's, you know, if you tell it automatically, it's going to go away and return and say yes or no. It may come back, if it is entailed, eventually it will find it, but it could take a very, very, very long time. But if it's not entailed, and the fact that it's not coming back and you've let it run for like 50 minutes and it's not back, or you've let it run for like 20 days, doesn't mean anything. If you have to stop it, it hasn't found it. Right. And things get even hairier if we're talking about higher order logic, you know, even second order, etc. Okay. So what we're saying is that the propositionalization seems to generate a lot of irrelevant sentences, right? So like I was saying before, for instance, you know, you may generate also things like, we have something that we never saw before that's not in the KB as a fact. So if it's not in the KB as a fact, it just means that, you know, if you want to prove that somebody is evil, you're never going to be able to show that this is true, to be able to discharge this as an assumption, right? So it's not going to be very useful. So even though you have it as a propositional thing there. So for instance, if you have this, that's what I'm saying, king X and greedy X implies evil X, and you have this, it seems obvious from this that we should be able to deduce that John is evil, right?
Right.
You know, if we have this and we have this, everybody's greedy, and John is a king, and if we have somebody who's a king and is greedy, that person is evil, we should be able to deduce that John is evil. But the mere act of coming up with all these propositional letters or propositionalization, it is a long word, produces lots of facts that, such as greedy Richard as well, that are completely irrelevant. So you end up producing things that are not going to be useful for you, right? Okay? So, and what we have is that if you have a P symbol, P predicates, which are all like K areas, so they have K arguments, right? And you have N constants, then you're going to end up with P times N to the K instantiation, right? Because each of the position of the argument, you can make it an instance, and you have P of these predicates. So it's pretty, it can get pretty big, right? Happy with this? So it's exponential, basically. What I was saying is that the number of instantiation that you can have is going to be exponential in the number of position that you have, in the number of, yeah, so that's the number of constants, yeah, n to the k. So that's not very good. But, you know, at least we're saying that if you don't have any propositional, if you don't have any function symbols, things look pretty good. At least if you, because if you don't have any function symbols, everything's going to be at level zero, right, in terms of the depth that you have to do things. So then your DPLL or whatever will work in the same way as they work on a propositional k problem. But if you have function symbol, then this is where you may need to do depth by depth, and it may not ever terminate. Okay? So this is all nice. So, but what we would like to be able to do is to reason directly in first order logic, and this is what we want to do now, right? And to be able to do this, we need to introduce the concept of unification. So we're going to just say, okay, we don't want necessarily to go to propositional level, because it's not always possible, or well, it's always possible, but it's not always effective. Let's see whether we can do something directly at the level of first-order logic. So we want to be able to do these kind of inferences. We want to be able to deduce that John is evil without having to deduce all sorts of unnecessary kind of facts that are not going to help us, right? And okay, so what is unification? Well, unification basically is the idea of finding a substitution that makes two terms identical, right? At least, you know, that's one, that's the basic idea behind unification. So we can get the inference that we wanted on the previous slide immediately if we can find a substitution theta such that king X and greedy X are going to match king John and greedy Y, right? So if you look at what we had there, you know, these are variables, right? So we want to find a way such that king X and greedy Y can match king X and greedy Y can match king X and greedy X and match king John and greedy Y, okay? So this is it. We're going to have some kind of unification algorithm that takes two sentences or two statements, and it's going to return the substitution such that it's true, this is true, if and only if the substitution applied to alpha makes it equal to the substitution applied to beta, right? That's all we want. Have you done unification? You haven't. Okay. So how do we make alpha and beta the same? What substitution do we do? It's actually easy, right, in this case. What's the substitution? We just make X, okay, Jane, right? And in this case, you know, if we have this, what happens? We make Y John and we make X OJ. And what do we do in this case? We make Y John. It's on the other slide, but it's okay. Let's try and work it out. And what happens to X?
Mother of? John, right? You made Y John. You need to propagate the substitution.
And what happens in this case? It's all, you actually fail because it's saying, you know, let's make X John and X has to be Richard, assuming these are constants and constants are distinct. This one will fail, right?
So this is exactly it. So, and usually, you know, that's one way of writing it. We're going to write X bar Jane, meaning this Jane is a substitution for X. Sometimes it's written in the other way as well, right? So, and there are many different ways of writing this. As long as you're consistent the way you write it, that's fine, right?
So all these work, but this one will fail. And what you can do very often is that what you should be doing is that if we're talking about this, if this is like, if this comes like for all X, John knows X, and for all X, X knows Richard. This X, even though, you know, if you drop the quantifiers, they're just X and X, but they don't have to be the same X, right? They're not, right? They're just saying for all X and for all X there. So one thing, you, because you could have written this for all Y, right? Y knows Richard. So this is this idea that you, what needs to be done is that to standardize variables apart so that you don't have overlap between variables that are not meant to be the same, right? So if they're not meant to be the same, if they don't have to be the same originally, then what you should do is this idea of standardizing them apart so that you don't have failure. And that's quite important, right? So in this case, what we can change is knows X, for instance, we can pick this one and change the X to some arbitrary variable that we've not seen, that's not there already, that's just new. Right? So Z underscore 17, just to show how arbitrary it is. Whatever. It could be Y. No, it can't be Y. No, yeah, it could be Y. In this case, right? And then we succeed by just making Z 17 John and making X Richard once we've renamed this one for the last case. Right? So this is something to bear in mind. If you're given a particular situation and you're asked, you know, okay, find out, you know, to do a proof or give the unifier for, you know, find the unifier for two terms. If you're given the terms, then they already, the variables are the same, right? So what you need to do is to standardize the variables apart, right? That's quite important, right? Because they're implicitly universally quantified. So just make the variables not the same, right? So just to look at unification again, so to unify this one with this one, right? So I'm going to introduce some other notion there. So to unify knows John X and knows Y Z, so now we're just saying, you know, we have two variables there, right? As you'll see in this case, we're making, where we have like standardized apart variables, so nothing is common between these two. Well, how do we do this? Well, that's easy. We can make Y John, and we just need to make X Z, right? So that's one possibility. We just say, well, this variable can be Z. But another possibility would be something like this, right? I could decide to make X John, right? Make also Y John and make Z John. That would also make the two terms identical because that's all what unification is saying. Give me a substitution, right, for the variables such that alpha and beta are the same, right? Right? But the question is, are these both equally good or should we, what should we do? Well, no, we want the unification algorithm to actually be better, to give us this one as opposed to this one. So the first unifier is said to be more general than the second, right? Because it makes less commitment to the, towards what the value of the variable should be, right? So this one is more general than this because it says, well, I'll just make X be this variable Z, but I'm not saying what Z is, right? Whereas this one is saying, let's make everything, give everything a particular value. So what we want when we're doing proof is to keep things as general as possible because, you know, you may not know exactly what Z should be, but if you're making it Z is John there, and later on Z is supposed to be Richard, you're going to fail. You're not going to be able to prove whatever you want to prove, possibly, right? So what's nice about it when you're talking about first-order logic is that there is a single most general unifier that is unique up to renaming of variables. What does that mean? It means that, you know, if I have Y, John, and X, Z, right, it's the same as saying Y is John and X is W. Up to renaming, it's the same, right? It doesn't matter what the names are in that case. So that's what this sentence is saying. You have a most general unifier, so something which is as general as possible. So look at this, most general, it's as general as possible, which is unique, right? So you only have one of these most general unifiers. Once you assume that if I have something, I can rename the variables uniformly across, it's the same, right? Up to the renaming of variables. Okay? So this MGU in this case is going to be Y is John and X is Z to make these two identical. So, and once we agree with this, the whole idea of finding these unifiers, right? You probably think, oh, it's pretty trivial to do this, but what you want is to have an algorithm of some kind to be able to do this, right? And the way, one way of presenting this is to view the algorithm that's going to find the unifier of two terms as an equation solving problem, right? So we're trying to solve the bindings or the solution for the variables that, and find the most general one that are going to make these two equal. That's all it is, right? So what is the most general unifier, if any, of the following pairs of formula? So if I give you this and this, without looking at the next slide, what is the most general unifier for this? Ooh. Anybody? So what do you make y? Yeah, what do you make x? Yeah, so that's the marginal unifier. Easy. What about this one? Yeah. Fails, right? It's easy to do it in this case, but if I give you f of g, yeah. So this one is easy. So this one just failed, right? Exactly. Y is John, and it's also the mother of x. So how do we find the MGU? Well, we're going to break it down into a series of steps. And we're going to give names to these various steps. One is known as decomposition, one is conflict, eliminate, delete, switch, coalesce, and occurs check. That's one presentation. So the presentation I'm doing in here, I find it easier personally than, there's another different type of presentation in Russell and Norvig where it's a usual pseudocode way of going through it. If you're asked about unification in the exam, right, and you say, okay, give the unification algorithm, you can give either the way it's presented here, but it's perfectly fine for you to give the Russell and Norvig way of doing it as well. If you're asked, right? I'm not saying you will be. But if you are, you know, there is, I just want you to know that there is an alternative representation in Russell and Norvig. And you're not going to be asked to say, give the representation, give the unification algorithm in the lecture, right? If you find the other one easier to understand, perfectly fine. Right? Well, if you ask that question, obviously. Yes. Well, who knows? Maybe you will be, right? Or maybe you won't. I haven't done the exam paper yet, so I'm still deciding. Now's your time to influence me, to get me to do the things you really like. No?
This is so hard. Oh my God.
That one, right? I know. You want the really, really hard bits, like, you know, what sort of environment is this? Things like that, right? Is it episodic? No, yeah, these are the ones. All the questions should be just about these. Obviously, all the questions after the assignment should be after constraint satisfaction, right? If you've understood it. Yeah. Right. Okay. Let's go through this step by step. Oh God. So I'm going to do the example. I'm going to give you the general rule, right? So, if you're given something like this, here's an example we've seen already, knows John X and knows Y Z, and the idea is that we're trying to solve this as an equation to find the bindings or the substitutions for the variables and the most general one, well, it's easy, right? So, it's just saying, you know, peel away this, so John is Y and X is Z. Really, you change it, right? So, in this case, you're done. You found the binding for Y and you found the binding for X, right? It's easy. Happy? And in general, so there should be another step there. It should be switching it around. I know it sounds pretty pedantic, but it's actually important. But you got the gist. So in general, given something like this, the next step, I have to be careful. This is not telling you it's a solution. It's just telling you one step. This is what decomposition does, right? The one step of decomposition is if you have something which is f of s1 to sn and f of t1 to tn, right? And the f's are the same, right? Replace with S1 this, S2. So these become the equations that you need to solve now, right? So try and solve it for each of the arguments. So basically, it's like you're recursing inside. It's a recursive step. Yeah? Good. Okay, and here's the other one, which is this conflict thing. It's fairly easy. If you have something like this, here's an example, knows John X and greedy Y, fail. Because there's no way this can be made the same. These are the function symbols, right? In general, if you have something like this, some f applied to s1 to sm, and g applied to t1 to tn, so you notice they don't have to be the same. Basically, if they're not the same, if the head of each of the terms are not the same, right, f is not equal to g, you fail, right? So that's the second step for the conflict, okay? And if you have something like this, this is the eliminate step. Right? What you're going to try and do is to eliminate a variable. So given that you have something like this, I'm trying to solve this, and I've already made some progress in terms of finding the solution for Z, right? I have knows John X and knows Y Z, and I know this, a binding. What I want to do is to get rid of Z in here as well, right? So you replace this, what you had there, the two them there, is John X, knows John X, and knows Y Richard, because that was the value that I had already, the binding that I had for Z already. That's the eliminate. Eliminate eliminates all the occurrences of variables that have already been bound to something, right? So in general, given P, right, something I'm still trying to solve, and part of the solution that I found already for, it is easy, is leaving. That I found for X, and X occurs in P, but not in T, and T is not a variable, right? Replace P, replace with P where X has, replace with P where X has been, T has been substituted for X. And this one remains there. So, by the way, right, so if you're giving these rules, it's not just saying replace it in there, you also have to say this, right? These are part of it, because you need to check whether the variable occurs in the other one you're trying to substitute. So this is all part of the rule. It's got to be in there, but not in there, because we're going to see this as a special case where you fail. And T itself is not a variable, because that's also another case. Okay? And another trivial one is, if you end up with any particular situation where you have some P and you end up with that S is equal to S, there's no way you can make further progress. You can delete this one. This is not telling you anything. So here's a situation there, greedy John, solving greedy John, greedy John. Yeah, you don't need to do anything. This could have been X there and X there, right? You can fail immediately. Well, you can delete that immediately, right? It doesn't have to be ground. So you just remove that particular equation. This is when you're trying to solve like a set of equations, and for some reason you end up with a solution that says X equal to X. It's not going to be very useful to you, right? So you've done something wrong usually, at least in arithmetic. And here's one there. So this is just, it looks trivial, but if you're doing it algorithmically, it's quite important. So given that you have this, John knows John X and knows Y Z, and you have something like this where it says Richard is equal to Z, you need to switch it around to just say Z is Richard, right? Sounds trivial, but it's just saying, you know, this is it, because so that you can do substitution in the other steps. So in general, given P and S equal to X, where X but not S is a variable, you can replace P and you can replace with P and XS. So you just switch this one. So tell me, why do you need to have this condition? X is a variable and S is not. What would happen if I didn't have this? What is this enforcing? This condition? No, not just that. What is it enforcing in terms of just this rule there, locally looking at this rule? I'm saying, you know, one is available, but the other one is not, then I'm allowed to do this.
Does it repeat the previous one?
Which previous one?
I forgot the name. It's kind of the same, but another one.
Forget about the previous one. look at just this one. What it tries to do is to say, if I've done the switch, right? I don't want to be able to go and keep doing switching and switching and switching over and over and just basically doing just that. That's what it's preventing it from happening. It says, if X is a variable and S is not, then I'm allowed to switch it around. But next time round, I've already done it. I want to make sure that I don't do it again, because otherwise there's a loop there, because, you know, it's just preventing you from doing this over and over. Happy with this, Jamie? That's all it's doing, right? So it's saying, it's preventing this rule from being one of those that can make the algorithm loop and do nothing really, but just keep over and over, just keep switching it around all the time, right? And another one is this one. It's related to the eliminate one, right? So this is the one that says, if you have something like this, John X knows Y Z, and Y has already been bound to Z, again, it's similar to eliminate, right? But you're just trying to say, okay, let's get rid of Y everywhere else and replace it with Z. So this becomes no ZZ, right? Given P and this, where X and Y are variables occurring in P, right? And it's slightly different from eliminate, because eliminate says, it's not the same as eliminate, because otherwise it would fail. Eliminate says X occurs in P, but not in T. Eliminate explicitly says if you've got an X on the side, this is not supposed to contain X, right? So, but this one is not saying that. Well, actually, does that matter? I'm just trying to think. Because if you had X equal to X, that would be removed by another one. Yeah, so the reason we have this particular condition is to make it so that it doesn't overlap with the one that we have for this, for delete, right? Because otherwise, if you had X equal to X, you would try and do the step blindly, but it wouldn't change anything, right? So these conditions are all there to make sure that the rules are all none of the rules overlap. So this rule doesn't overlap with this one, for instance, right? Because this one is saying if you see where they're all the same, both the same on both sides, you just delete that, right? Otherwise, if you didn't have this particular one where you say x occurs in p but not in t, you could have x equal to x, and then you would try to do a substitution that does nothing, right? Remember, if you're implementing this, that's the problem. The problem is, if you look at this, you think, you know, this is obvious, right? Because a lot of it you can do in your head. You think, you know, well, you know, it's obvious. I'm not going to try and do a substitution with x equal x in the other parts of the term that I'm trying to solve, right? But because you can look at it and you can say, well, that's not going to do anything for me. I just want to delete it. But if you were implementing this as part of an algorithm, you would need to be able to do these checks explicitly, right? Because otherwise, it cannot distinguish between this situation where you have x equal to x there, and you could try and x occurs in there, right? So let's assume this was like z equal to z. Well, that's not a good example. Well, this one. So if this is this, and you have z equal to z, right? And you didn't have this check where x doesn't occur in on the right-hand side, you try to substitute, nothing would happen, right? You would need to do the test. That's what this prevents from doing. You really want it to be this case. So this is the coalesce one. Yeah, so you have y is equal to z. So in general, given p and x equal to y, where x and y are variables occurring in p, can just replace x with y. And finally, we have what's known as the occurs check. If you have something like this, x, we want to make this identical to the father of x, we need to fail, because otherwise eliminate will loop. So this one has a dependency on a previous rule, right? So what would happen if you were allowed to do this, here's an example, if you have p of x, right? And you have this particular solution for x, x is the father of x, then the next step of eliminate would have p is the father of x, right, and x is the father of x, but then you could keep going. You can keep substituting in there. And you end up with like p father. So basically some infinite data structure, so just something that keeps going, right? So this is known as the occurs check. So in general, given x equals s, where x occurs in s, and s itself is not a variable, so this is s is not a variable, this is to prevent it from overlapping this one, right? Then you fail. So basically, if you have a function symbol applied to some term that contains x, so if you have some term which is more complicated than just a variable that contains x, you need to fail. And do any of you know about Prolog? Yeah, so one of the things that happens with Prolog as a programming language is that very often the occurs check is actually switched off. Unification plays an important role. So why is the occurs check, why do you think it's switched off? If you had to implement this, what would be one of the issues with the occurs check? You know, it's easy to look at this and say, okay, if x were father of x, hey, I look through this and I find x, yeah, it's there, I fail. But imagine now, right, you have to do this each time for all, each time you're doing unification, and this can be arbitrarily deep and it can have an arbitrary number of arguments. So basically, before you do any step, you need always to do the occurs check. It becomes very expensive very quickly. Because if you have to do each time you're, like something like Prolog, which relies on unification so much when you're trying to do depth-first search as well, and each time it's trying to make two identical, it has to do all these checks for each two terms it's trying to unify, even if it's going to fail ultimately, right? So what would happen is that it really slows down everything. So in Prolog, by default, very often the occurs check is switched off because it sort of assumes that hopefully we can get away without doing the occurs check. But what this means is that in theory, right, if you were using Prolog to try and do inference, you could end up with something where you have some infinite data structure like this, something where it doesn't stop. So really, you could do something which is unsound, so if without the occurs check. But just bear that in mind. You know, this is a trivial example, but it could have been father, whatever. Keep going. Right, so you need to go all the way down in the term and explore the whole tree for the term to figure out whether this variable occurs somewhere in there. And if you have to do this each time for whenever you're trying to run the unification algorithm, well, not just each time, right? Even in the unification algorithm, you would need each time to check, right? Each time you're trying to solve for a variable, you would need to do. So in the running the unification algorithm once, you have to check each time. So you would have to do the occurs check over and over. So that's quite expensive. So just to show you an example of this, working where we just do the steps, it's assumed we want to do our problem from before, where we want to solve for this and find what the bindings are for x and y. Well, we do the decompose there, so we end up with this, so this peels this away. John y is identical to, you know, we want to solve John is equal to y, and we want to solve x is equal to mother of y. So we can do our switch step, right, that just switches this around. Once we've done this, we're there, we can do the eliminate. So this means replace all occurrences of Y everywhere else by John and this. And once you're there, you're done. There's nothing more. So you found the, you know, it gives you a systematic way of finding what the unification, what the substitution should be for X and Y. That's all. So if you look at these steps there, if you know these steps and you can apply them systematically, you can solve any of the kind of unification issues, unification problem that you're given. And of course, you know, the way this tends to work, if you're looking at an exam question, if you look at the past exam papers, you'll see there are some questions about this. It's always going to be, you know, some particular situation where it can be a bit tricky, where things become a bit weird once you start doing it. At first, you look at it, you think, yeah, there should be a solution. But because of the way the bindings get propagated from one term to another and then back, you end up with actually the occurs check making it fail eventually, for instance. And it's not necessarily immediately obvious that this will happen. So if you don't do the steps systematically, or for instance, these steps, then you might end up missing it, right? Of course, you can do the algorithm as well. So just bear that in mind. But if you understand these steps, it's really, yeah, it's a good exam question to have because it's really not that difficult. But people still get it wrong. Yeah, it's because they look at this and say, oh, look at all these steps I have to memorize, right? Really, I'm not asking you to memorize the names, right? These are names that were made up by Alan Bundy in his book. So, you know, if you know what the steps are and you don't remember what they're called, that's fine as well, right? As long as you can tell, as I can tell what's going on, if you ask a question, you know, what the step is doing. I'm not saying, you know, you need to remember that this is called necessarily coalesce or whatever. You can call it whatever you want. But just make sure it's clear what is going on. Any questions? Yeah? Okay, so this is all very good. So why do we need all this? Well, now we can introduce the generalized modus ponens rule. So it's a generalization of the modus ponens. So what does it mean? It says if I have a number of facts, P1 prime, P2 prime, to PN prime in my knowledge base, and I have a rule there, which tells me if I have P1 and P2 and dot, 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 and PN, and this implies Q, right? So you'll just notice it's just a generalization of this where we have more facts and this has more antecedents, right? Right? If it's possible for me to unify all the facts, or to unify the N facts against, well, look, let's take it that way. If it's possible for me to unify the antecedents, right? So to make the antecedents of the rule there, of the implication, I'm able to unify them with N facts from the knowledge base, right? It's probably nicer to turn it the other way around, but it's okay, it's the same. For all I, if I'm able to find ways of basically saying, you know, these are all true because they unify with facts from the knowledge base according to particular substitution, then I can deduce Q of theta, right? It's just a very general way of doing it. So modus ponens is just an instance. So another way of writing this, is if we're not looking at this in a propositional way, would be that I would have something like this there, right? And then let's call this A1 prime, and this is A1. So what I want to do is that A1 prime theta is equal to A1 theta. And then I end up with B theta. This is just a special case of this general rule, right? That's all it is. Happy with this? So here's our example. Here, for instance, we could have in our knowledge base that P1 prime is King John, P2 prime is greedy Y. And then this is the rule we had before, right? If you remember, we had like for all X, King X and greedy X implies evil X, right? So P1 is this, P2 is that, and Q is evil X, right? So what is the substitution that's going to make this identical, this one identical to that, and that one identical to this, right? So we're just trying to unify. So how do we unify this with this? It's easy. X is John, right? And we unify this with this, right? Y is X, but we know that X is John, so Y is also John, right? So what does it mean? So this means then we just apply, we can deduce this immediately from one step, that evil John, Q theta. So Q is actually evil X, but we know that X is John. So one step of the generalized modus ponens rule, we can do it immediately. We can deduce that evil John, which is what we were talking about before. Whereas if we're doing the propositional version of this, where we transform the database and knowledge base into a propositionalized problem, then we end up with more work because we'll end up with all sorts of propositional, for instance, like greedy Richard and maybe even King Richard and all this that we don't need, that are not useful to us, and just makes the search bigger. Yeah. So generalized modus ponens is usually used with a knowledge base of definite clauses. What does that mean? It means you have exactly one positive literal. Positive literal is whatever is on the right-hand side of the implication. So you only have one thing on the right-hand side of the implication, right? Because remember, if you transform this into, if you remove implication, you have negation of this or this. That's the positive one, right? That's what this is saying, right? And all variables are assumed to be universally quantified as well, okay? So one thing, so how do we know this generalized modus ponens is sum? We can do this. If we assume that modus ponens itself is sound, we can reduce the soundness of generalized modus ponens to the soundness of normal, just the usual modus ponens. So if we want to show that P1 prime and P1 and to Pn prime are facts, and we have this rule that this entails Q of theta. So remember, soundness means if I derive something, it is actually, it was originally entailed. I don't try to derive something that's not entailed by the knowledge base. That's what soundness means. So we want to show that this, the rule together with the facts, are going to entail Q of theta, provided that we find this theta that's going to make all of these P1 equal to this up to Pn equal to this. Well, P1 prime equal to this and up to Pn prime equal to Pn, right? And it's really easy to look at this. Well, fairly easy. So for any sentence P, we know that, so it's all coming together, right? So we have that P entails P of theta by universal instantiation. You remember this, right? We have this. So universal instantiation rule tells us that if we assume it is sound, that P entails P of theta, right? It's just substitution, right? But we can write this. So then we can say if we have this rule there, so this is the general rule that we have the general implication there. Well, this entails this, right? So we're just saying, you know, if we have this, applying the substitution to the whole rule is entailed, right, to the implication. And then we can basically see, what does it mean to apply substitution to a term? You can apply it to basically to all its constituent terms in there. So it means that P1 theta and dot, dot, dot to Pn theta implies Q of theta, right? So this is just equal to that. That's what application of substitution is. I didn't mention this explicitly, but that's what it is. And if we have these as